book is out, Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself, a memoir. Eileen Rockefeller is here with us. Nice to see you, Eileen.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
The book is about the experiences of being born into this family, and then more or less you're on your own journey to try to figure out who you are.
Yes, as I said to somebody the other day who said it took 6 years to write this book, and I said, well, that wasn't nearly so long as it took to become myself.
Right. But do you think even if people wrote some of these stories for themselves, you know, their own personal stories, do you think that's helpful for
Oh,
growth?
very much so. I've been a journaler since I was 8. I think I probably have 100 journals. Or more, and any kind of reflecting back to oneself can be useful. And I think one of the difficulties we have in families is that we don't always get reflected the real truth of who we are. We get reflected a piece of the truth and a piece of the projection that they've placed on us.
And do you think families do that out of love, though? Do you think they think we're going to protect or
Oh,
protect or?
yes. I think most parents. I would say virtually all parents are wanting to do the very best thing, but we all grow up somewhat broken, and our challenge in life is to become whole. And so, in the process of it, we hurt people inadvertently.
Right. Well, your thing about, like you said, being broken and coming up, because most of society would look at you and think, you won the lottery, what a lucky thing that happened to you. But that comes with a price as well.
Well, of course it does. And yes, it is isolating to be different in any way. It doesn't matter whether it's the color of your skin or the size of your body, whatever it is, if you're different, you feel like isolated sometimes. And people will treat people differently because of assumptions that they make. And in the case of my name, they made assumptions that I would maybe be stuck up and that I would be condescending to people. And my mother always said, you get double praise or double blame. So you choose.
And you knew that as a little girl. I mean,
I did.
you were
I
taught that
did.
early on.
Yes.
And your
Well,
mother struggled marrying into this family as
she
well.
did. I think she really understood the feeling of being different. And probably the story that illustrates it best is when she first was with my father, and they'd gotten married, they were spending a year living with my father's parents while he wrote his PhD thesis, and they lived behind some black iron gates on the estate. And one day, some friends of my mother's who'd been used to just stopping by in Bedford in the countryside and playing or hanging out, they came up to the gates, but unannounced. And the people at the gate turned them away because they didn't know, they hadn't expected them. And that was probably one of the most difficult blows that my mother experienced in becoming a Rockefeller.
Because there was a formality to this lifestyle. There was a way to do it properly, right?
Yes, there was a formality, and there was a kind of natural physical isolation by living behind gates, which many people do today.
Yeah, we've all kind of taken that on, haven't we?
Yes,
A
yes.
gated community is considered a good thing, but you're already saying that there's a price to pay
There is a
with
price
that.
to pay, and I so wish that my book would help encourage people to find community in wherever they can. We can't always find it in our family of origin because it is being destructive in some way, even if it wasn't intended. But what we can do is find other people who love us and who support us and support us in our own growth to becoming whole.
Right. So shared interest and also being around people that aren't like you, I think is a very
Very
positive
important.
thing.
It is. You would not believe how diverse my friends are. I mean, I love people of all kinds and I have so much fun. And, you know, I chose to marry a man who comes from a different faith,
Yeah.
and we have blended our faiths together. And my husband is Jewish, and the very first conversation Paul and I had when we went on our first date were the ways in which we felt that Rockefellers and Jews were similar because you're looked at and assumptions are made, and you can feel on the outside. But also there's the shared values of family and of the love of nature. And so we discovered our closeness partly in our shared values, but even from very different backgrounds.
But you also say for Paul, when you guys got married, it wasn't easy for him. And it also wasn't easy for you because you didn't know how to really fight properly or what any argument meant. All those kind of things.
Oh, that's a great thing you bring up. Who knows how to fight properly? You know, you're either going overboard or not doing enough. I mean, the thing about fighting, which every good marriage needs to do mm-hmm. in order to get past the issues and get behind them, is that you have to find balance. And it's always a little sketchy. You don't know where it's going. It's messy. It's mm-hmm. messy to fight. And it's messy to be yourself.
Well, part about, I think, your book is about being a Rockefeller. And I think that it's a mistake that we make in the American culture is that we think if we have money,
yes,
then we're done. Everything's happy from that point on. You were born into this mm-hmm. world, and happiness is not a...
It's not a given, even with money. And that is a point that I want to make to people. I'm sure many people don't believe it because our culture and all the advertising you see on TV or you hear on radio is always leading you to believe if you just had that car, if you just had that bigger house, or your kids just went to that private school maybe instead of the public, mm-hmm. whatever it is that you could acquire with money is only part of the way. It's no more all the way than it was for me to have access to almost anyone that I wanted to in starting my nonprofits. You know, from the head of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center to a professor at Harvard or a Nobel Prize winner, I could get through the door because I was a Rockefeller, but I couldn't actually get beyond that unless I proved myself as a person. And I think that's the point, is that money can buy us part way, mm-hmm. but it's what we do with it that really counts.
And it's about experiences and also about, and it's tough to explain this to people, but when you're in service to ideas or other people, that's where real satisfaction comes in.
Absolutely. And when I was involved with the Institute for the Advancement of Health that I founded in 1983, there actually were studies going on at that time about the value of altruism mm-hmm. and how altruism has a physiological effect that people are healthier and that they're happier. And I don't know about their blood pressure goes down. I don't remember all the facts, but I know that people who do good for others feel better and are healthier by and large.
And you were involved in mind body work when it was still considered pretty crackpot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. In fact, Norman Cousins was my mentor, and he was considered crackpot, too. But his book, Anatomy of an Illness, got such acclaim in the public, who was just on this tidal wave of interest, mm-hmm. that they couldn't ignore it. But what I did was to go beyond Norman to include him, but to find and bring together, and this was the great convening power of my name, was I brought together all the heads of the sort of subfields of mind-body, like the founder of psychoneuroimmunology, the founder of psychopharmacology, of biofeedback, and many others. Dean Ornish, who's now very widely known mm-hmm. for his reversal of heart disease through social support and diet and exercise. He was our first grantee from that institute. In fact, he got his first grant from us, is what I wanted to say. And it was the forming of the community of those people who had all been mavericks and had to fight their way up to be seen. And by bringing them together, it gave them a voice and it gave them a confidence that they hadn't had that enabled them to help organize the field of mind-body health.
And now we're almost this quickly at a point where it's a given.
I know. Isn't it amazing?
Yeah, where doctors are like, oh, I can't just come in and out.
Yeah.
But you saw that happen over a couple of decades. And it's another one of those things where people think change can't be made.
Yeah.
But it's happening all the time, isn't it?
It is happening. And it's not always obvious in the moment, but then when you look back 20 years, all of a sudden, wow.
Yeah.
It really has changed. And I think the same will be seen for social and emotional learning in schools. I'm one of the co-founders of the Collaborative for Academic and Social and Emotional Learning. They're out of the University of Illinois in Chicago, and CASEL, the acronym, stands to promote social and emotional learning for kids pre-K through 12th grade. And when we started out, no school really had any programs, but there was so much trouble with bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've discovered by researching the effects of the implementation of good social and emotional skills in the classroom is that kids who have good SEL do 11% better in their academics, and they're happier and healthier. So it's an extension, actually, of mind-body health.
And that's what keeps happening. This keeps moving into other areas. Oh,
yes.
It works over here. Where else can we move it? You know, I was just talking about this yesterday on the air after the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
We, just the same way that you say that we're marketing that money solves thing.
Yes.
At the same time, we're marketing a culture of fear. And we're
yes.
trying to make people, I think, afraid.
Well, I
homes.
Agree with you, and fear is the quickest way to cut off creativity. So how do we reverse that? Well, I think, you know, the obvious trite answer is love,
mm-hmm.
but there are many forms that it can take, starting from the support of parents. So parents just really listening to their kids, of having meals with their children whenever they can. And, I mean, at least once a week, if there was a formal, ritualized sit-down meal where they really listened, that's when you get to know what your kids are up to, and it's also how you begin to transfer your own values, just by the stories you tell and how you listen.
And you really didn't have that as a young person,
oh,
right?
I did. Well, I did. I mean, I wasn't at a table with my parents until I was maybe 10.
Uh-huh.
Not regularly, but on weekends, always.
In nature and...
Well, but I was at the... Yeah. I was able to sit at the table with them
mm-hmm.
at lunches and dinners on the weekends. And then the weekdays, they were more involved. But I believe that a lot of their values got passed down through dinners together. And my mother told stories as partly a way of keeping all of us from... boxing each other or
right.
being disobedient or something. And she was a very good storyteller.
And your father's in his late 90s.
Yes, he's 98.
And a lot of that has to do with, I think perhaps, the outside interest in nature
yes.
that he had. To be involved in nature, I think, is so powerful, and so many of us forget it today.
Oh, thank you for raising that. You know, I think nature is one of the greatest healers, and partly it's because in nature, think of it, there are no judges. You
mm-hmm.
take a walk in the woods, you're not hearing a tree saying, you ought to hurry up.
Yeah, right.
You know, the wind might blow, but it's not trying to push you. It's just blowing.
Yeah.
And that's the difference.
And it's a place that it's hard to be a critic because it's
yeah.
pretty humbling.
It is.
So you wouldn't sit there like if you see a movie, you have a certain amount of criticism. But if you're standing in front of some trees, you have to admit that it's pretty amazing. You know,
it is. That I thank you for that. I actually hadn't thought of the inverse of that, that it's hard to criticize nature, too, because
mm-hmm.
it is not a critic. And yet it can be such a beautiful example. There are so many metaphors I take from nature. For example, the most obvious are the seasons and how, you know, if there wasn't winter, we might not understand about pause and rejuvenation.
Right.
And, oh, goodness, just the way that there are different colors and different moods and
mm-hmm.
different speeds and paces of wind and clouds and trees and leaves.
It's why gardening is important on some level, too, because you're in touch and you're just like,
literally.
Oh, I see time going by and I'm part of this thing that happens.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and you can make mistakes. I mean, I tell a story in my book about trying to grow fava beans
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if you read that one, but I had them completely upside down. And our gardener was just so forgiving as the earth. And he said, oh, it's okay, it's okay. And I realized later, you know, they're going to just do quiet somersaults and keep on growing.
Yeah, life finds a way.
Yes, life is so resilient. Mm-hmm. And that's another major lesson from nature. It's such a great example to us because life is tenacious, it's resilient. And even after these horrible storms that we're getting and sadly are going to probably get more of with global warming, you know, the earth will survive. We mm-hmm. may not survive, but the earth will.
Because that's what it does. At some point, we have to think the same way. What do we have to do to survive? And it seems like some of that is got to come from us working together.
Absolutely.
We have such a competitive society,
yes.
and there's gains to be made there.
Yes.
But at the same time, we've gotten away from working together. I mean, you see it in our own government right now.
Absolutely. We see it everywhere. And I'm so glad that you raised that because I think that our country is coming increasingly from a place of scarcity. And I understand that because ironically, even though my family had an abundance of money, I and my siblings all felt, or I'll speak for myself, I felt a lot of scarcity. But it was scarcity of attention, scarcity of being seen, scarcity of feeling comfortable in myself. And so if a whole government and if the people in the country now as a culture feel like there is a paucity of enough of whatever, it drives people apart. So this is why I think probably one of the most important things we can do is go inside and listen first to ourselves really deeply and do whatever it takes in the community of those who loved us and love us to heal whatever are those wounds. Because through the healing, we find amazing abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't cost anything.
That's already there.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, untapped. Also, something that we're not really teaching our children. You know what I mean?
No.
We so want to prepare our
yes.
children for this competition that we forget to remind them that you're already winning. You're already having the life experience.
Yes, yes. I think that's a beautiful way to think about it. And there are so many ways of winning, whether it's just getting up and getting dressed in a way that you like in the morning, or maybe you helped somebody across the street, or you stopped to listen to your child, or you listen to your grandparent, or you listen to somebody you've never met before but who's holding out a hand for money.
Have you seen any of or read Tom Shadyac's book? He's a it could almost be a companion piece.
Wow.
He is a comedian that is a film director and lived the American dream. And once he got the money, he found out he was not excited by it and then turned around to live the kind of life that you are talking about now of
How
connecting with people.
Tom Shady?
Tom Shadyac is it.
Shadyac.
I'll see if I can't get you a copy of the book.
I would love to read that.
But I think it's very interesting and maybe somewhat in our zeitgeist right now
yes.
that more people are talking about this.
And I hope that more and more will because we are at a tipping point right now, and we're either going to go over the cliff or we're going to climb the mountain, but we're going to do it together.
It is definitely a choice between abundance and a scarcity.
Yes,
you know?
It
really is. Thank you so much being a Rockefeller, becoming myself. It's really Eileen's journey, but it's the human journey, I think, that is
yes.
most interesting, and that you put together a way that most of us are on this trip anyway. Thank you so much for stopping
thank
by.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'll see you next time
okay.
coming through.
Okay, bye.